But one of the benefits of preaching in a series through a book, which I won't have this morning, is you can easily refer back to passages and remarks which have been made already in the book to help illuminate what we're considering in the present sermon. And unfortunately, I won't be able to do that quite so easily. So if at moments it seems a little bit clunky, me sort of pulling us back to previous sections, do forgive me for that. But I do want us to remember as we approach this passage in Mark chapter 2 that we do so in a certain kind of context. We do so in the context of chapter 1, verse 14. Now, after John was arrested, that verse begins. John the Baptist has been arrested after what at first looked like a rather fruitful ministry. The Messiah's forerunner has clashed with the authorities. And so as we read through these early chapters in the book of Mark, we find ourselves wondering, well, if John's been taken away by the authorities, what about the Messiah himself? And already, Jesus has provoked a certain level of objection to his ministry. There have been silent objections from the authorities. Back in chapter 2, Jesus forgives the sins of a lame man, and that causes a stir among the Pharisees who witness that event. They keep their words to themselves, but inside they burn with anger. They're thinking, that is blasphemy. Who can forgive sins but God alone? And as chapter 2 develops then, we encounter a series of further incidents. Silent objections now become verbalized. They now become spoken objections to Jesus. First in the form of seemingly innocent questions, but then soon developing into out-and-out accusations. And this morning I just want to consider the first of those two objections, those two incidents. Objections in verses 13 to 17 and an objection in verses 18 to 22. Now, we could consider these accounts as separate incidents, but I've chosen to consider them together this morning for a couple of reasons. Firstly, because Luke's gospel certainly gives the impression, if you read chapter 5 of Luke, that these incidents take place on the same occasion. But even in our own passage, they are united by a similar theme. They are united by the theme of the dinner table, by the theme of eating. And it's in this area then of dining, of eating, that Jesus receives these two complaints. I call them complaints. As I said, on the surface, they are just questions. And I'm not saying that everyone who's asking these questions of Jesus is making allegations of him. But the context of these comments at least suggests that what at this stage looks like just innocent questions will soon evolve into outright allegations. They'll soon become reasons for rejecting the ministry of Jesus in and of itself. And so I want us to consider these objections this morning, and I want to consider the way in which Jesus handles them. So the first thing we see here is a complaint about company. A complaint about company. Now, if I'd read the earlier part of this book, we would have recognized that chapter 2 takes us in verse 13 into familiar territory, but we're back on the shores of Galilee, and we've spent a while on the shores of Galilee. If we look back to chapter 1, verses 16 to 20, there we see Jesus is passing alongside the Sea of Galilee, and we see a very dramatic incident takes place. Jesus calls some disciples. He calls these fishermen, Simon and Andrew, James and John. And these fishermen then are, as it were, yanked out of their day jobs. They leave their nets behind. They leave their family business at the door. And at the drop of the hat, they come and follow Jesus. It's quite a dramatic event. He just calls them and they follow. And I would just suggest to you that, just to set some context for us, conveys for us the strength even of Jesus' authority even in these early days. There was something about his character which meant he could just sidle past someone and say, "Follow me," and there was something about that, those words, which drew that person instantly towards him. And so that's then considering that authority of Jesus. But there's something else going on there which we should also not miss. There's another astonishing feature going on in that passage where he calls those fishermen to him. It's not just the authority he carries in his voice, it's also the people he's directing that authority towards. He is calling fishermen to follow him. I mean, Jesus, as we've said, he is this great divine king who is coming to establish this kingdom. He is coming to rescue a lost world which has been held captive under the power of the devil. And who are the first people he recruits into his army? Well, he recruits fishermen who just happen to be in the right place at the right time, just going about their day job. So that's the context I want to put this in. And now we arrive at verse 13 in chapter 2. And again, we see Jesus calling. We see his authority. We have this call in verse 14, "Follow me." And again, we have the astonishing immediacy. This man, Levi, just leaves his booth and instantly follows Jesus. And yet, I'd put it to you that we see here something even more extraordinary than that. Because with the previous chapter, yes, we said that Simon and Andrew and James and John, they were hardly the most obvious recruits to be the generals over the army of Jesus. Fishermen. But what about this man, Levi? You see, Levi is also a very unlikely candidate for the job. His day job is the kind of job you think wouldn't appeal to a mighty Messiah. But you see, here, it's not that his occupation is strange because of its ordinariness, like a fisherman, or its roughness, or its simplicity. It's not that Levi is the kind of man who smells of fish and who has hands full of scars and has a laddish sense of humour or anything like that. That's not what makes him an unlikely candidate. You see, it's not that Levi is a nobody who's been selected by Jesus. No, it's that Levi is a somebody, and he's a very unpopular kind of somebody. Levi is an unlikely candidate, because Levi is a tax collector. He is a man who is employed under the unpopular government of Herod Antipas, which itself was subordinate to the Roman Empire. He was a man who was in the business then of squeezing whatever he could out of the pockets of his fellow citizens, handing it over to those dislikable authorities, and then profiting from whatever else he could swindle out of them. Levi was an unlikely candidate because Levi was a traitor. He was a member of the establishment. He was seen as a traitor to the common man and to the nation as a whole. And as a man who did business with the Gentiles, those who weren't Jews, he would have been seen as deeply impure in the eyes of the religious authorities. He would have been expelled from the synagogue. He would have been completely despised. He would have been cut off from the community. And so he was deeply unpopular with everyone. His job carried this serious social stigma. And yet, perhaps this was the most galling thing about it, Levi was the kind of man who was prepared to go into that kind of job knowing full well what other people would think of him for it, and yet doing it anyway. He was doing that not because of some higher principles, not because of some moral allegiance to the Roman Empire. No, the very opposite. He was doing it because of the money. He was a social outcast because of his own free choice. He was isolated from high and low alike. And that was not by accident, that was because of a commitment to his own greed. You see, there are people in this world who are social outcasts, and we can find ourselves looking upon them with pity, with empathy. We can stretch that far. It's not too hard. We think of the homeless man, or the drug addict, or the alcoholic. And we look at those persons, and although we can't quite get ourselves into those shoes, perhaps for some of us, For other, you know, we can at least sort of sympathise, we can at least sort of work out how they've got there, and they can at least pull on our heartstrings. But then there are those outcasts in this world who even the most charitable of us would be inclined to think they should just remain outcasts. Levi was one of those people. That's what made Levi such an unlikely candidate to join Jesus' company. And yet, Levi is seized. He is seized from that tax booth and he becomes the latest recruit to Jesus' followers. And yet the surprises in this passage just keep on coming, because notice how the scene now shifts in verse 14 to verse 15. In the space of a verse, we find ourselves now seeing Levi reclining at table with many other people like him around him. And when I say reclining, that word, even in the Greek text, has that sort of sense of luxury about it. It's not just another word for sitting down at the table. No, reclining has that sense of, you know, Roman banquets with the guests spread out across the couches. Now, whether that was literally happening here or not is not important, but what is important is that Mark chooses that word, that luxurious word, reclining. And so what a strange scene we have now. This outcast who we all look down upon is now pulled at this table, surrounded by other outcasts, and enjoying this sort of luxurious feast is the way that Mark chooses to depict it. And as Levi looks up and down this table then, who does he see? He sees a room filled with tax collectors. And not just tax collectors, but sinners of all shapes and sizes. All the twisted people, all of the despised folk, all of the perverts and the gamblers and the people that we find ourselves very difficult to sympathise with. They're all reclining here, if we use the word which Mark is using, like cultured Roman aristocrats sitting around this table, eating and chatting with Jesus of Nazareth and his scruffy disciples. And so I'm just trying to get across to you, there's a sort of absurdity in the way that Mark is depicting this. It's a strange image Mark is painting for us here. And it's an image that, as we will go on to see, is bursting with deeper significance. But for now, it shouldn't surprise us that somebody puts in a complaint to all of this. You see, to eat with these people, to eat with sinners and tax collectors, is to be intimate with these people. And by being intimate with these people, Jesus is putting more than just ritual purity at stake. It's not just his ritual cleanliness which he's risking here. Back in chapter 1, Jesus touches a leper, someone with leprosy. That was an issue of ritual purity. That would have shocked people, because no one touches a leper. You will contaminate yourself ritually, ceremonially. But the concern here is not ritual. It's more of a moral nature, isn't it? This is not simply a table of lowly people like those fishermen, or unclean people like that leper, or ill people like the paralytic in the previous passage. You know, surely for all their haughtiness, a Pharisee could see something commendable in helping those people. No, this was a table full of bad people, sinful people. Jesus, a friend of sinners, was causing a moral dilemma in the minds of these Pharisees. It's possible that we don't quite grasp just how scandalous it was for Jesus to be a friend of sinners and tax collectors. We can sort of forget, can't we, that behind all of the sermons that Jesus preached and the touching interactions we see there in the Gospels, we are also encountering in the Gospels a man who, for many, was a friend. He was more than just a friend, of course, but he was not less than a friend. And as these sinners then sit around this table with Jesus, they are more than just a mere audience around him, listening to him, offering his teachings. No, they are a community, so to speak. Yes, they're listening closely to his words, but they're also enjoying the casual Jesus. Jesus, their friend. The same Jesus who commands the lame man to walk, also asks for the bread to be passed down the table so he might receive it from his friend, the tax collector. So this is a scene of friendship and leisure. And for that reason, it is scandalous. And for that reason, then, people start to ask questions. Does not bad company corrupt good morals, Jesus? Or perhaps it's that your corrupted morals have attracted this bad company after all. Questions must be asked. And we arrive then in verse 16 at our first very explicit question asked by these Pharisees. Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners? Ask the Pharisees. And Jesus answers that question very straightforwardly. And I would just say to you that whoever you are this morning, whatever your circumstances, please just listen to what Jesus says here and let these words, these simple words, sink deep down into your ears. Verse 17. Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners. And I would say that if that comment means nothing to you this morning, if it's neither a comfort nor a rebuke of some kind, then I would suggest you really fail to engage with it. See, for some people, this comment, it has a very sharp edge to it. Isn't there a twinkle in Jesus' eye as he directs that comment to those Pharisees? Don't worry, he says to those Pharisees, I didn't come for perfect righteous people like you. Oh no, perfect righteous people like you have no need of someone like me. Don't worry about that. Just mind your own business. It's quite an infuriating, sarcastic little comment when you think about it, isn't it? But you see, the point is very clear, isn't it? Jesus is saying, I'm not here to spend time with all those clever, moral, perfect people who think they've got it all sorted. I'm not here to join some kind of religious echo chamber where I can talk down about all those lesser people out there. That would be like qualifying as a doctor only to attend medical conferences and never actually deal with sick people, just thinking about sick people were a bit of a waste of time. No, that's absurd. No, Jesus is sitting at a table of sick people who know they are sick and who have found the physician. That's who he is here for. He is here for those who know they are sick, who know they are sinners, who know they cannot conjure up their own righteousness within them, and are just coming to Jesus as the great physician. And that is what he is there for. But you know, there is a sickness worse, actually, than the sickness of Levi, the tax collector, and the sinners who sat around with him. There is those whose sickness leads them to believe they are actually well. That is how deep their sickness goes. There are those whose sin has blinded themselves to their need, and perhaps even fooled them into believing that they are therefore the most righteous of the lot. People who can say with a clear conscience, as to the law, blameless, says the unconverted Saul. It's these people who have so much trouble then with Jesus, friend of sinners. Let me put it very plainly for you this morning. If you think you are doing quite all right without Jesus, if you think you are well and upstanding and moral and you don't need anything else, then let me only say this. Fair enough. Jesus has not come for you. That's what he says. He says, if you think you're righteous already, listen closely. I came not to call the righteous. If you look on a gathering of broken sinners, on a church congregation, and you look at that group and you're appalled, and you're confused, and you want nothing to do with those kinds of people, listen again. I came not to call the righteous, says Jesus. If you look at the church across the UK and all you see are just poor, weak, foolish people with dodgy backgrounds who are fawning over this Jesus guy, and you think to yourselves, I'm above all of that kind of thing, again, listen. I came not to call the righteous, says Jesus. I remember a day at university when I was speaking to some friends. Me and a Christian friend were talking about our faith with another friend I had who was on my history course. And this Christian friend I had, he's not the most physically attractive of all people. He looks quite unhealthy in some respects. He's got a very peculiar appearance, very strange personality. But one thing you can say about this Christian friend is that he is a changed man. And he shared his testimony with this other friend from my history course. And he explained to this other friend how, as a teenager, he used to burn with hatred inside of him. He used to desire revenge upon those who bullied him. In fact, he actually said that he studied physics at university for the simple reason of learning the scientific know-how so he might be able to punish his bullies later on in life with particular pain. And so he shared this testimony with this other student. And he spoke to this other student about how there came a day when his friend offered to him Pilgrim's Progress. And he took that book and he started to read it. And although he did not want to read that book one bit, he found himself moving from chapter to chapter so quickly. And then he reaches that point where Christian reaches the foot of the cross in Pilgrim's Progress. And Christian's got this big burden upon his back, and he reaches the cross and he looks up and he sees what happened at that cross, and the burden comes off his shoulders and rolls down the hill. And my friend said the moment he read that, the same thing happened to him. His burden fell off. And he realized he was converted. He was saved by Jesus. And as he told this other friend this story, I thought, this is just going to melt his heart. He's just going to see how great a change has taken place in this man's life. He's just going to be convinced. He's just going to be persuaded by the loveliness of Jesus. He's just going to see that Jesus is this friend of sinners and he can come to him as well. And what was the result? My friend on the history course said that my other friend was psychologically disturbed. He was messed up. And for that reason, he wanted nothing to do with his religion. He wanted nothing to do with his Saviour. And again, I just read this passage and I say, if that is you, if that is your verdict on Jesus and on those who come to him and follow him, listen to Jesus' words. I came not to call the righteous, says Jesus. But if, on the other hand, you have in yourself even the tiniest little doubt that you might not be the righteous this morning, then please carry on listening. Because while the self-righteous bars himself, prevents himself from sitting down at that table with Jesus, it's the self-conscious sinner who until now considered himself outside of the bounds of that forgiveness, who now finds himself spending an intimate time with and a close space with and eating from the same table with Jesus, the Saviour, the friend of sinners. Surely you would agree with me that anyone in their right mind would want to be right there in this man's presence. And if that's you this morning, then I simply say, if you know anything of your sickness, if you know anything of your sin, if you know anything of your internal weakness and inability, do not hesitate to come to Jesus Christ, whether it's the first time or whether it's a constant process in your life of coming back again and again. I say to you, draw back to this table. If Jesus had room for Levi, then he has room for you at that table as well. You are most welcome there. If you feel your sin, that is no obstacle. That is your very invitation to come to that table. Come to Jesus. There is room at that table. Others can complain about his company. That's nothing to do with him. He doesn't care about that. He invites the very worst of us, if only they will acknowledge that and they will come and they will come to their great physician who will heal them. So that is this complaint about company that we've seen, and we've seen Jesus' response to it. But now enter into our passage the second complaint. This is a complaint in verses 18 to 22, not about company, but a complaint about consumption. A complaint about consumption. See, this complaint also concerns food, but it's not a complaint which is so much directed at the eaters, but at the nature of the eating itself. The question being asked is this one. Why do John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast? The question is, why do Jesus' disciples not observe the kind of ritual ceremonial fasting which is observed by John and is observed by the Pharisees? Now, we don't know who's asking this question. Perhaps some people were asking it with complete innocence. However, if you were to go into Matthew's Gospel and you were to read Matthew chapter 11, you would see that that same question is asked of Jesus there, but this time it's not an innocent question, it's a question which is characterized as a sort of vicious slander. Listen to what Matthew chapter 11 verse 18 says. This is what's said of Jesus. For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say, he has a demon. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, look at him, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. You see, there, this question about Jesus' eating habits compared to John's is an accusation, it's a complaint. And so I'd say that, once again, in our passage, we are seeing a similar line of inquiry. We're seeing the question, why is it that you feel the need, Jesus, to sit down and eat all of this food when people who take their religion much more seriously, like John's disciples and the Pharisees, can restrain themselves a little bit? And Jesus answers that question in verse 19 by asking another question. Jesus asks this question in response. He says, can the wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? And then he gives them their answer. As long as they have the bridegroom with them, they cannot fast. The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and they will fast in that day. See, Jesus, he doesn't dismiss fasting per se. He's saying there is a time coming when that fasting will resume. But for now, he compares himself to this bridegroom who cannot help but be a cause of celebration. And celebration then involves eating and drinking. Jesus is saying, how could anyone fast when I am here? With me, every meal is a banquet. With me here, there is joy for everyone. Incidentally, this is why Jesus can't just be a mere man, can he? Because no mere man can make those kinds of claims without being seen as a deluded narcissist. You know, everyone should be happy around me. But that is what Jesus is saying. He is saying he really is the source of merriment and joy and happiness. I don't just mean that Jesus is claiming to be some kind of fun, dynamic personality, that he has just an infectious sense of levity. That's too trivial. But at the same time, we mustn't fall into the trap of thinking that, you know, the joy that Jesus brings is really some kind of deep, esoteric sort of thing which is almost divorced from real emotional experience. No, Jesus brings real joy. The joy Jesus brings to these dinner guests doesn't go alongside hardship and struggle, because in its very nature, it sort of removes all of that. It removes mourning, it removes struggle. All of their previous sadness in that moment with Jesus is overwhelmed by the joy the bridegroom brings. Sadness is not allowed to survive. And yes, sadness of some kind would return once the bridegroom had departed, but for the time being, it has no place around that dinner table. You see, fasting is all about removing one's attentions from immediate pleasures. It's about sacrificing those immediate pleasures and for a season devoting yourself to gaze upwards to God with undivided attention to him in prayer, such that food doesn't distract you. It's about self-restraint, it's about discipline, it's about steadying yourself, it's about postponing natural human impulses. And in a world which is often horrible and chaotic and worrisome, then there are going to be times when it feels very natural to restrain from eating and to devote time to God in prayer. to eat in a time of chaos or a time of sadness or a time of grief will just feel like the least appropriate thing to do. But the point here is that in the immediate presence of Jesus, that desire to fast becomes a thing of the past. Jesus' physical presence brings relaxation and reclining, as we said before. It brings that sense of liberty which allows the hand to stray across the table and take another fruit from the fruit bowl. And so fasting then in Jesus' presence wouldn't merely be inappropriate, it would be that, but it would also raise serious questions about whether you're taking the joy of the bridegroom seriously enough. And so then, when the Pharisees ask this question of Jesus, I think there is a sort of cloaked criticism, isn't there? There's a concern here that Jesus and his disciples are just not taking religion seriously enough. They're not taking the spiritual life seriously enough. They're sort of promoting hedonistic attitudes. That's not a serious kind of religion. And Jesus here, he's turning that on his head and he's saying the very opposite. He's saying, were my disciples to fast in my presence, that would be deeply inappropriate. That would be not taking their bridegroom seriously enough. Once you understand who I am, you will realize that joy in my presence is the most appropriate, most natural thing of all things. And to close then, I just want to finally consider these last two verses of our passage. This analogy Jesus uses of wineskins and garments, because that really brings us into this point that Jesus is making. Jesus says there, "No one sews a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. If he does, the patch tears away from it, the new from the old, and a worse tear is made. And no one puts the new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the wine will burst the skins, and the wine is destroyed, and so are the skins, but the new wine is for fresh wineskins." The point is simply that old wineskins are not stable vessels for new wine. You can't just put the new wine into the wineskins and that be appropriate. And in the same way, you can't just put a piece of new cloth and old garment together without there being a rip. Bringing those two things together is inappropriate and it's disruptive. In the same way that you can't lay down old worn carpets in a flashy hotel, that would be just as inappropriate. In the same way as you can't invite mourners to attend a wedding, that would be very inappropriate. Jesus is simply saying here that these two things just do not go together appropriately. And in the same way then, the kind of fasting which might have been totally appropriate when people were still watching and waiting for their coming Messiah, now is by no means appropriate once that Messiah has arrived. Jesus was not to be contained in that old restrictive wineskin of the past. If you tried to do that, you would spoil everything. Celebration is a serious business, and if you try to make it more serious by making things more severe, then you actually end up undermining the serious goodness of the moment. You end up profaning what is meant to be enjoyed. So where does all that leave us today? Well, we're in a peculiar situation, aren't we, this morning? Because on the one hand, our bridegroom has been taken away, as Jesus says in verse 20. That's a very strong expression which he's using. And he's simply speaking of the very violent way in which he will be taken away from them. But at the same time, we live at a place in history where we can look forward to Jesus' second coming. Jesus has ascended, he has taken his throne in heaven, he has given us his spirit, and we are simply waiting for his return. He has come once already. So we're not back in square one. We're not back where people were prior to him coming the first time, but he has been taken away from us. And so what do we do with this then? Well, in a sense then, we are back in that day of gazing back towards the invisible God and praying and fasting for his personal return. Fasting is very much appropriate at our point in history. But nevertheless, we must be clear. We are not back to square one. And as Christians this morning, we have the privilege of looking at this passage, seeing those sinners reclining in their seats, reading of this bridegroom and all of the feasting which he brings, and saying to ourselves, he's come once already, and he's coming again. And when he comes, he will prepare the greatest banquet in the whole world, and guess what? The food's already cooking. And are we not then this morning those who, at least in the smallest way, have tasted that first drop of that new wine? We've had our first little nibble of the first starter. We know what he's like when he arrives, and we are looking forward to him coming once again. There's a family at our church in Newcastle, and they invite you over. They're a very hospitable family, and you're sitting there to begin with in their living room, and you're nibbling on these little bits of crisps and these little sipping from these little glasses of mango juice or whatever it is, and your stomach is rumbling, and you're wondering about what the next course is going to bring for you. Little do you know that there is another five courses in line before you finish. And so it's almost like that then. We're in that first little waiting room and we're just having that little bit of a nibble of those crisps and a little bit of a sip of that drink. And the smells of the banquet are still kind of making their way through the corridors and tantalizing us in the living room as we're looking forward to that great banquet which is to come. And so I simply say then, look into this passage and allow it to give you an appetite for what is to come. Yes, we are in a day when the bridegroom has been taken. Yes, we're in a day of fasting, but we also know that something is good is coming. A banquet is being prepared, and the oven is already on, and the food is already cooking, and it's only a matter of time before we're able to enjoy it and sit down and recline at that great table filled with all of our friends, filled with all of those sinners who have been washed in the blood of the Lamb. And we can look forward to that as we meet together and as we worship him. We do so in anticipation of the great day when he brings us together with him and we can get to enjoy that banquet of the Lamb of God. Amen.